Tonight, to stand up and kick this session off with Martin Luther King's legacy and Martin Luther King's vision for a people-powered movement to end police brutality this year in 2016. So we're going to look back someday from now and say that in 2016, the leaders in the Maryland House and Senate came together to end police brutality and heal the relationships between communities and police. Those who are meant to protect us should not be those that we fear.
As the Maryland General Assembly begins its session, activists push for legislation to end current laws that grant impunity to police officers who kill or brutalize. And it's the first anniversary of the F word. We'll spend the date with author and activist Gerald Horn. All that and more coming up. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. Well, thousands of activists around the country reclaimed the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend with rallies, protests, and acts of civil disobedience. Black Lives Matter activists shut down the San Francisco Bay Bridge for an hour on Monday, and airport workers in several cities, including New York, Boston, and here in D.C., marched and blocked traffic in the fight for $15 an hour. On today's show, we'll go to Annapolis, where activists staged a die-in on the holiday to demonstrate against police killings and brutality in Maryland. Then in the second half, it's the one-year anniversary for the F-word, our monthly discussion about fascism and pre-fascism, and author and activist Gerald Horn will join us. But first, our headlines. As part of Reclaim MLK weekend in D.C. on Saturday, activists demonstrated at 14th and U Streets to protest city policies that they say are investing in police, disinvesting from communities, and have driven away the homegrown go-go music culture in the city's African-American community. Chantel James spoke to one of the organizers, Dominique Hazard.
We're out here today. We're a part of a series of actions that are happening across the country about Reclaim MLK. So we want to reshift the conversation about Martin Luther King and his legacy to his really radical work about economic justice. So he was assassinated while he was working on labor rights and organizing black people for economic justice. And so we're out here today and we're connecting it to things that are happening here in D.C. So we're here at the Reeves Center. Municipal Center for the City used to be a site of a couple go-go clubs in D.C. Of course, go-go is the indigenous music of black people in the city. It has really been a target of push-out. It's been a target of the city, and the city has tried and really succeeded in pushing go-go out of the city. And so in 2010, they had these things called go-go reports, and whenever a go-go band was scheduled to play in the city, the police would send it around to all of the police, and they would show up, shut it down. They've been, you know, all the go-go clubs that used to be all on U Street, which is now the source of so much gentrification, have been denied liquor licenses and really pushed out of the city. And so we find that push out of black culture really symbolic of different types of push out that are happening here in the city. School push out of students in D.C. schools, school push out of students, the push out of residents from their homes because of gentrification and lack of deeply affordable housing, and all that really exacerbated by the development deals that folks in the city have been cutting, which is another reason why we're here at the Reeves Center, of course, under Mayor Gray. The Reeves Center was part of like a land swap in order to get a stadium in the city. And so the city was like, we're going to basically give away this land for pennies on the dollar to developers in exchange for the stadium, right? And so Mayor Bowser, while she took the Reeves Center off the table in that particular deal, has been the architect of a lot of deals like that in the city, where the city is deeply investing in developers instead of investing in the city. And so what we really want to see is Mayor Bowser and the council to divest from state violence here in the city, jump outs, the type of police behavior that killed Alonzo Smith and invest in restorative justice in our schools, invest in deeply affordable housing, invest in community control of resources and land. So we're out here today. We had a video showing some of our demands. And on top of all that, we're here to celebrate. We're still here. We're still Chocolate City, and just celebrating black culture and black joy as we fight against all these different things.
That spirit of resistance for the MLK weekend is continuing through the week. Yesterday, Black Lives Matter protesters interrupted the press conference held by the U.S. Conference of Mayors at the Capitol Hilton in Northwest D.C. D.C. activist April Goggins stood on the stage with a sign that read, 16 shots in a cover-up, hashtag Laquan McDonald, hashtag resign Rahm, referring to Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. The mayor of Flint, Michigan, Karen Weaver, was also on hand at the press conference and told reporters that the crisis of contaminated water in her city has been allowed to occur because the majority of the city's residents are black and poor.
It's a minority community. It's a poor community, and our voices were not heard. And that's part of this problem. Like I said, this has been going on for almost 2 years, and the citizens, the community, spoke out about this shortly after the switch was made to the Flint River water, and nothing was done. And they marched, and pastors got together, and it wasn't until Mark Edwards and Virginia Tech came in that people even started listening to what we were saying, and then our medical community spoke out. That was a year. That took a year for us to be heard. So I was glad that she brought this added attention to this and made that comment. And that is why also the state and the national NAACP got together and put out a statement as well, because this is a civil right. Water is a basic human right, and everybody deserves clean water.
Starting at noon today, in just about an hour, We Are Cove Point invite you to join them at 711 15th Street here in Northwest D.C. to ask Bank of America to stop funding the gas refinery, power plant, and export terminal that Dominion is building in the densely populated neighborhood of Cove Point in Lusby, Maryland. More info is at wearecovepoint.org. That's today at noon at 711 15th Street here in Northwest D.C. Also, today has been declared the Day of Visibility in Oklahoma City as the sentencing is scheduled for serial rapist and former police officer Daniel Holtzclaw, convicted of raping women, at least 12 of which were African American. Follow hashtag Say Her Name or the African American Policy Forum for more information. Tomorrow, Stop Patriarchy and other feminist organizations are gathering at noon in front of the Supreme Court to celebrate the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision that made abortion legal and safe. The gathering will also be a counter-protest to the annual March for Life held by anti-abortion activists. More information, including weather contingencies, is at stoppatriarchy.org. On Tuesday, January 26th at 10 a.m., two delegations of Native Americans from the Great Plains and Southwest will be among those protesting at the EPA as part of the Clean Up the Mines campaign. That's a national campaign to clean up thousands of toxic abandoned uranium mines throughout the U.S. that poison the air, land, and water. And more information about that is at cleanupthemines.org. And next Wednesday, the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent is a United Nations body of independent experts dedicated to improving the human rights situation of the black diaspora. And they'll be here next Wednesday right here in D.C. at Union Temple. That's 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And that's Union Temple is at 1225 W Street Southeast in Washington, D.C. And listeners to this show know that we have been talking for a while about taking our case international, making our demands, our voices known to an international body. So here it is, the UN, right here in the DMV, to hear about issues such as police brutality and killings, to talk about gentrification, displacement, lack of affordable housing, jobs, all those issues as they concern the African-American population in the district and also in the larger DMV region. So to get more information about that, I know you can get in touch with PACA, and I believe their email is PACA, P-A-C-A, at protonmail.com. So in our culture and media moment, author and political science professor Lester Spence, who has joined us several times on this show, will be reading from his new book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, tonight at the Potter's House. What he does in this book is he charts the effects of the neoliberal transformation on African-American communities. And Lester Spence is the associate professor of political science at Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. That's tonight at the Potter's House. And also, speaking of books and entertainment, Scholastic is pulling a controversial new book about George Washington and his slaves. The book was titled A Birthday Cake for George Washington. It was released on January 5th, and it was met with criticism because of its depiction of happy slaves who were happy to bake George Washington, their master, a cake. And documentarian Michael Moore is joining Jada Pinkett and director Spike Lee in boycotting this year's Oscars because they have, once again, shut out people of color from the acting nominees. And those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, voices from a rally in Annapolis to urge changes in laws that govern police conduct. Stay with us.
The problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
I'm living in that 21st century, doing something mean to it. Do it better than anybody you ever seen do it.
There's kind of creative tension in our society where people are forced to pay attention to issues like that.
Won't you celebrate with me when I get shaped into a kind of life?
Count the hours.
That's going to determine if the special police officers are going to be indicted for the murder of my son.
That it is a crime to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
We have nothing to lose but anxiety.
Dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
That was sound from a video mix for the Movement for Black Lives here in D.C. by Jonathan Likes. And he produced that for the action on 14th and U that happened over the weekend. Well, now to Annapolis, where a crowd gathered on Monday night to kick off the legislative session for the Maryland General Assembly to demand a change in the so-called Police Officers Bill of Rights that, among other provisions, grants police officers in the state 10 days before they must speak to investigators in a case when they kill or brutalize someone. The first voice you'll hear is Larry Stafford, Jr., Executive Director of Progressive Maryland.
We're here tonight to stand up and kick this session off with Martin Luther King's legacy and Martin Luther King's vision for a people-powered movement to end police brutality this year in 2016. So we're going to look back someday from now and say that in 2016, the leaders in the Maryland House and Senate came together to end police brutality and heal the relationships between communities and police. Those who are meant to protect us should not be those that we fear.
That's right.
And so with that, I want to bring up the Reverend Janelle Bruce, who opened us up in prayer.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
If we can all just lock arms with somebody, we're going to heat it up. Lock arms, lock arms. If you got a sign, it's okay. Don't drop your sign. And we can just bow our heads. God of love, God of hope, God of justice, we call on you tonight. God, we're here because your people are dying. We're here today because your people are hurting. We're here today because we're tired of unchecked, abusive police power. God, we're tired of seeing our children, our sisters, our brothers, God, die by a system of injustice. God, we need you to move on our behalf. We need you to heal our land. Right now, we pray for the heart of every single lawmaker that walks through these doors and sits as a public servant. We thank you now for removing those that perpetuate hate and racism and injustices in our state. We thank you right now for moving on the hearts of our elected officials and prompting them to say enough is enough. God, awaken our moral conscience. Awaken the spiritual consciousness of your people. When our legislators sit in their seats, God, let them remember Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland and Michael Brown and Tanisha Anderson. God, we thank you that the police in our state and across our nation will be held accountable for their actions. May the spirit of every great police officer be contagious. May officers have the courage, God, to call out the injustices and the abuses of the powers they see.
Right.
Thank you, God, right now that we won't stop fighting and we won't stop writing our representatives and we won't stop protesting until we see the changes in the system, until we see a change, God, and until our system is based on true and equal justice.
Yeah.
Thank you right now for strengthening every single activist standing here in this circle and across our state. God, thank you that my sisters and brothers out here for the first time are being awakened and strengthened now to fight for others, God, to fight for our lives and to fight for the lives of other people. God, give us the power to galvanize like Dr. Martin Luther King. Give us the courage to lead as boldly as Harriet Tubman.
Yes.
Give us the wisdom and the diligence to study like Malcolm X,
yes.
God, and the very strength and peace of Maya Angelou. Give us what we need to fight. God, we're here because we're ready.
Yes.
Use us to bring forth justice. Help us to strengthen one another when we become weary from the fight, God.
Yes.
Remind us, God, that we are our brothers and our sisters' keepers.
Yes.
God, we ask for you to awaken those who are still sleeping. Let them know that we're called to actually do justice and not
yes.
talk about it as some unattainable ideal. God, awaken our churches. God, awaken our leaders. Let us see ourselves when we look at to the eyes of other people. Let us see ourselves, God, no matter our race, religion, gender, sexuality, economic status, or anything else, God, that we tend to judge each other on. May your spirit bring healing to the families of the victims. May your love abound. Let your kingdom come and your will be done. God, we avail ourselves tonight to be used for justice, God. God, we believe that we're going to win, God. Right now, we claim the victory, God. We claim justice for this state, God. We claim justice for this nation, God. And we thank you for the mighty move. In your name we pray. Amen.
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 And if you agree, why don't you just shout, I believe that we will win.
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 And now bring up Delegate Diana Fennell, the Secretary for Maryland's Black Caucus.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Good evening. You know, as Larry
First of all, Progressive Maryland, let's give you all a round of applause and everyone that's out here that's who's braving this weather. Give yourself an applause, please. As Larry stated, I am with the Black Caucus, and we are, and we will make sure that we hold police accountable for their actions. We will. Come on now. We will. What we going to do?
We will.
We will hold police accountable for their action.
And now we'll bring up statewide renowned poet and a speaker for justice, Lady Breonna. Yeah.
What do we want?
Justice.
And when do we want it?
Now.
What do we want?
Justice.
And when do we want it?
Now.
And if we don't get it?
Shut it down.
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 Is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles.
Silence.
Greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. My mother said, don't be afraid to ask for help. But what if help is an illegal chokehold around an asthmatic throat, a smoke bomb before dawn, and a bullet hole left in a seven-year-old's dream, a severed spine, rubber bullets ricocheting off picket signs, tasers, tight-fisted billy clubs, and mace lethal enough to blind. We treat officers like they're gods, and then we give them guns to unleash their wrath and fury without a judge or jury to provide the scrutiny and check or balance the death and injury they sentence without reserve. Accountability is a refrain used to attack Black communities and their leaders, a frame for not good enough, not powerful enough, a point finger from the FOP's once itchy trigger finger. They will kill your kin and then tell you it was your fault for letting them sag their pants too low, wear their hoods too high, drive a fancy car in an at-risk neighborhood, look like a drug dealer, or have a Black body that one could assume was up to no good. But accountability is not a police officer's duty, but rather a matter shielded by the badge and blue uniform. Transparency
is a myth.
Yes.
It's the abominable snowman of City Hall,
and we ain't seen that yeti in years.
That's right.
Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. We say Black Lives Matter, but laws do too.
That's right.
Because in civil society, there's no discipline without legislation and policies to answer to. Yet the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights in this state protects officers when they fail to protect us.
That's right.
Creating barriers to gaining access to information, prohibiting interrogation, even if somebody's blood has painted the pavement, the officers caught red-handed cannot be demanded to make a statement for 10 days. God created the heavens and the earth in less, and we cannot get justice unless we start to demand more, like a civilian on the trial review board. Because what's the point if officer is able to grab the gavel? They all soldiers in the same battle, so they rather tote guns right than tattletale. An officer will never send a fellow cop to jail, so guilty officers go free.
That's right.
Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. Justice never really seems to prevail, and the community is unengaged like a bride pre-veil, unless its voices raised and hands up in the streets. But we should not have to disrupt the peace with loop videos and mainstream media on repeat for us to get a thorough investigation for instances of police brutality. I swear, cares. Right. Power concedes nothing but a bigger bully with a better bang. So we will not see change until cops fear their freedom will not remain if another black body is unlawfully slain. Silence is greater than shackles, and knowledge is tougher than knuckles. And we want justice.
That's right.
Or else.
That's right.
That was powerful.
Very powerful.
So now I want to bring up another set of powerful women, the mothers of some of the victims that have lost their lives to police brutality in the state, Ms. Marion Gray Hopkins and Darlene Kane.
Good evening, everyone. And gosh, it's cold out here, so I want to thank you all for coming out. But first up, I would like to give honor and thanks to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. For had it not been for him and the work he had done, we probably would not be here standing in Lawyers Mall in Annapolis today. We all continue to hope that Dr. King's dream for justice will come true. But as the mother of Gary Hopkins Jr., a young 19-year-old college student unjustly killed by Prince George's County police, I have not experienced justice, nor have other mothers across the state of Maryland and across this country experienced justice.
That's right.
I am here not only as a mother of a child that was taken by police brutality, but I am here as a member of the Maryland Coalition for Justice and Police Accountability, and also as the president of Coalition of Mothers Concerned. We have buried our children, and mothers who we fear burying our children, but we will never bury our belief in each other and our right to raise our children. We want officers to be held accountable.
Yes.
At least one person of color is killed by law enforcement every 28 hours or less. And this, again, Maryland is not exempt from this terror.
That's right.
But we understand as mothers, there are some concrete truths. Justice will not come unless we fight for it.
That's right.
Justice will not come until we fix this broken system.
That's right.
If our children are truly to be our future, we cannot allow genocide of our black and brown children to continue, allowing those in law enforcement to murder our children with impunity.
That's right.
We're not going to win this battle, however, as individuals. It's going to require us to work collectively by organizing in our churches, civil organizations, and our homes. Joining collectively works, as it clearly has been evidenced by the work of the Maryland Coalition for Justice and Police Accountability. We gave our recommendations and our demands to the work group, and some of our demands were implemented as a recommendation. We still have work to do, so therefore we need all of you to work together if we are to bring about accountability and implement reforms needed to stop the free will of officers to kill people of color. In closing, we resolve the Coalition of Concerned Mothers will not stop, cannot stop until we taste a fruits of justice. Thank you.
Thank you, and good night.
And so now we're going to have a musical performance by Jordan Gavin, Ariana Garvin, and the Restoration New Life Church Lead Singing Group.
Freedom land, ain't gonna let no hate
phone and talking, walking up to freedom land.
So now I want to bring up one of our fellows, our student organizers from Howard University, Miss Elsa Lekou.
Hey guys, so I know we're really cold outside, so I'm hopefully this chant will definitely help out. I'm gonna say fists up, you say fight back. Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Put your fists in the air. Come on now. Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Fists up,
fight back.
Awesome. So, I just have a couple of words here to say before I introduce some of our members. I am with the Maryland Coalition for Justice and Equality. As you guys know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is definitely at the center of this event, and he once said that riots are the voice of the unheard, and you will hear us. And this is most certainly the case in Baltimore after Freddie Gray. Riots took place because this is what happens when you create so many different elements that are so toxic that, you know, riots end up happening. And I just personally want to say to some of these legislators here, even though they're not here with us, black folks most certainly do not need your remorse. Black people do not need any more of your tears. What we need you to do is pray, yes, but pray on your feet. And what do I mean by that? Pray on your feet by going into your offices, advocating for accountability legislation to finally be passed. That's the type of prayer that we need. That's the type of action that we need. We are here to demand an end to the 10-day rule, an end to the 90-day statute of limitations, and finally advocating the passage of civilian review. And that is exactly what this coalition right now is trying to advocate for.
Can y'all hear me out there?
Yeah!
All right, my name is Lawrence Grand Prix. I'm with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We're a grassroots think tank in Baltimore City.
LPSK!
Mike, I want you to remember a few things about these so-called reforms. Even under, if everything they proposed passed, Maryland's Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights will be roughly the same as Arizona's and Louisiana, even after reform. And on top of that, the provision Sarah is talking about is straight out of Rhode Island. They took the worst provision from Rhode Island and brought it on down south here to Maryland. So I want you to think about that. That's the way that they've played the game here in Maryland for years. Tell you they're going to reform, put the knife 7 inches in your back, pull it out 3 inches and call it progress.
A
wise man once said that. Are you going to play the game or are you going to change the game? Are you going to play the game or are you going to change the game? All right, so we need you here every day. We definitely need you here in April. Right now, we're maybe willing to hear the process. If they continue to not hear our demands, we are going to disrupt the process. And if they continue to not heed the demands of the community, we'll be left with no choice but to try to end the process.
And if we could just bring up next, Michaela from City Block.
I'm Michaela Gilliam Price, and I'm a student organizer from City Block, which is a student grassroots organization from Baltimore City. So while we've been in this fight together for years, before even April happened with the murder of Freddie Gray, we need to make 2016 different. This is not the year to be reactionary. It's not the year to wait until another baby is killed. It's not the year for the next Freddie or Penny or Renisha or Tamir. It's not the year to wait. It's not the year to wait for another Sean. It's not the year to wait for another Trayvon. We have to start to fight now to save our babies' lives, not being in the street after they've already been killed. But again, this is also not the year to be fractured. It's not the year to let our movements be fractured and to be embodied in different struggles. We need to understand that we are all in a fight to restore our humanity collectively as a community. And then to that point, it's also not the year to let our babies fight for our community's lives and us not to be standing there with them. We have thousands of kids in Baltimore City who are in the streets daily, who are in their schools daily, fighting for the rights of students, of their communities. We have students, Latino students, who are fighting for the rights of their immigrant families. We have black students. We have black students who are daily engaged in a fight with the school-to-prison pipeline, and we need to see the overlap and the intersections of all of these struggles, because without each other, we're going nowhere. But also in 2016, it's the year to take our protest demands to legislators like this one. It's time for concrete change. It's not time for abstract chants. It's not time for abstract prayer. We need concrete change. If we are not changing the material conditions of our people, we are not making change at all. If we are not saving our babies' lives, their physical lives, or we are not protecting them every single day when they wake up, every day when they're on the bus going to school, every day when they are returning home, but we are not protecting the integrity of our community, we are not doing anything. So 2016 is the year to change, because united we stand.
No justice,
no peace.
No racist
police.
No justice,
no peace.
No racist
police.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. And you just heard voices from Monday night at a very boisterous, loud, and very cold rally outside the Maryland State House to demand a change in the so-called Police Officers Bill of Rights that, among other provisions, grants police officers in the state 10 days before they must speak to investigators in the case when they kill or brutalize someone. And when we come back, we're going to take a brief break, but when we come back, we'll go to Professor Gerald Horn and our first anniversary of the F word. Stay with us.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say, we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around.
We're young, we're strong, we must love that love. We're young, we're strong, we must love that love. We're young, we're strong, we must love that love. We're young, we're strong, we must love that love. We're young, we're strong, we must love that love. We're young, we're strong, we must love that love.
And welcome back to the show. Well, as I was working on this show for today, I was trying to get more information about this report from Oxfam that indicates that right now the 62 wealthiest people in the world own as much wealth as I think the poorest 3.5 billion people on the planet. And I thought that we could kind of work that into our discussion today for the F word. This is a segment we've been doing for a year now, and so this is our anniversary. And we've been looking at the issues of fascism and pre-fascism. And we kicked off the segment last year with Professor Gerald Horn, professor at the University of Houston, author of more than 24 books. I think I might have to up that to 36 soon. And he's gracious enough to join us again to mark our 1 year of doing the segment. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So when we did kick off this segment last year, can you kind of urge caution about talking about fascism? You know, is this a fascist society, despite the fact that we have this tremendous, overwhelming private money in our election system, private prisons, all types of things that you know, cause us alarm, that, you know, you urge us caution in terms of describing it as fascism, because, for example, you said we couldn't even have this conversation. So I've kind of modified on the radio if this was actually a fascist society. So I've kind of modified the segment over the year to talk about pre-fascism. And I've had some really good discussions with you and other thinkers and writers and activists. So I'm wondering if you have changed any of your thoughts or you've developed some more ideas about the subject over the past year, given everything that's happened in this country and abroad.
Well, first of all, I'd like to compliment you personally for raising this issue. Some might say prematurely, but actually what you've exhibited is a kind of vision, that is to say, ability to see around corners and see over the horizon. Because if you would do a simple Google News search, you would find that mainstream commentators are now raising the question of fascism in a very pointed fashion in light of the rise of the two GOP presidential aspirants, Donald J. Trump and Ted Cruz of Texas. Interestingly enough, this is even coming from the heart of the Republican establishment. Even the Koch brothers, believe it or not, Charles Koch, in a recent interview with the Financial Times, denounced Donald J. Trump. And this billionaire, I think, realizes that if these fascist trends continue, what that portends is a reshuffling of the U.S. ruling class and U.S. ruling elite. It's a game of musical chairs, and it's unclear who will have a chair to sit on when the music stops. I should also say that what is going on in Eastern Oregon is symptomatic of what you envisioned over a year ago. That is to say, the growth of armed militias, the fact that these Euro-American men have taken over a territory the size of Massachusetts while brandishing guns at federal agents, which one would think is an indictable crime. As many have pointed out, certainly it would be an indictable crime if yourself or myself or someone who looked like us were to do that. But what's even more striking is that a system of dual power has been established in Eastern Oregon, the size of Massachusetts. That is to say that they've established their own courts, and you have federal officials who have gone into hiding as a result. Now, this oftentimes is a prelude to a counter-revolution when you have dual power established. But I should also say that this idea of counter-revolution, which is a precursor to fascism, could be well seen as a major trend throughout U.S. history, particularly since 1776, when the country was established. And as I pointed out in the book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, you could see the establishment of the United States itself as the result of a counter-revolution. So certainly there are very disturbing and troubling trends to point to. One more point before I cease speaking, and that is part of the problem is the weakness of the U.S. left. You might have noticed that Ta-Nehisi Coates, the celebrated author of Between the World and Me, just denounced Democratic presidential aspirant Bernie Sanders for not endorsing the idea of reparations. According to Mr. Coates, Bernie Sanders is in the forefront of denouncing plutocracy and raising questions of class privilege, but he seems hesitant when the question arises of race privilege. And for Bernie Sanders to simply say that he didn't think it could pass Congress is a laughable comment, because does he really think that single-payer health care, which he also supports, is going to pass Congress soon in 2017, or that his trillion-dollar infrastructure investment bill is going to pass Congress? More than that, Bernie Sanders had an outlet. Any Washington operative should know that Congressman John Conyers of the Congressional Black Caucus has submitted a bill for a number of congressional sessions, basically calling for a study of the idea of reparations, H.R. 40, and Bernie Sanders, if he had been briefed thoroughly, could have done that old Washington dodge and say, I support H.R. 40, I call for a study of reparations, then could have had some choice words denouncing slavery, and he would have solidified a base in the black community. As it is, he's on the defensive.
Right. Now, you mentioned a dual government in Oregon, and that made me think about Flint, Michigan, and also what's happening in Detroit. And this whole issue of these executive managers that are appointed and they're not elected. And for me, and I think a number of people, this seems like a dual government. It seems to particularly impact communities of color, communities of African Americans. And it's almost like they're testing out to see how far they can go. Now they've poisoned an entire community. And you have people who are impacted for years to come and for the rest of their lives by this. And so, how does that fit into our discussion? I mean, if we're talking about a dual government in Oregon, it seems like the very government in the state of Michigan has set up a dual government.
Well, you are as perceptive as you ordinarily are. It's not only the idea of dual government that has arisen in Oregon, I mean, the idea of these executive appointed managers, like in the city of Detroit, which basically eviscerates the power of the voters of Detroit, who are 80% of African origin. It's also the notion that the right wing in this country is seemingly coming to the conclusion that it's going to be very difficult for them to win the presidency in coming years, not only because of the possible nomination of losing candidates, or hopefully losing candidates like Ted Cruz, but also they feel that if that is the case, that they will be losing the presidency, then they need to chop down the powers of the president. And so you see a number of maneuvers to do so. For example, the recent case taken by the U.S. Supreme Court on President Obama's immigration initiative that was initiated by the state of Texas, one had thought up to that point that presidents had a certain amount of latitude in terms of issuing executive orders. But the federal court that ruled against President Obama basically restricted what had been the president's rightful authority to issue such orders. And in the opinion or in the words that called for an examination of this case, the Supreme Court rather ominously said that they would like to examine whether or not Mr. Obama is faithfully executing the laws of the land. This, according to certain legal commentators, sets up a case whereby the powers of the presidency will be circumscribed further. Add to that that Governor Greg Abbott of Texas is now calling for a constitutional convention to further, among other things, limit the powers of the presidency. But with a constitutional convention, all bets are off. That is to say, the basic charter, the U.S. Constitution of the United States, could be rewritten. And who knows, they may decide to write Jim Crow into the Constitution. So you are correct to point to these very dangerous and ominous and troubling signs that are now on the political landscape.
So as we speak, Davos is underway, the economic forum there. And at the same time, Oxfam has put out this report saying that the 62 single wealthiest individuals on the planet own as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion people. So I've been for the past year kind of toying with this idea about, you know, what is the relationship between oligarchy, which is, I hear that talked about also. I hear some commentators warn about more about oligarchy than they talk about pre-fascism or fascism. So what do you think is the connector between those?
Well, this is also a very dangerous, ominous, and troubling sign, this disparity of wealth, which is really hammering the U.S. working class and middle class, and I might also say hammering the white sector of the working class and middle class, which also underscores why they become so desperate. It also underscores the folly of commentators like Robert Reich, who in a widely circulated article that you can find on the internet entitled Who Lost the White Working Class, he suggests that the Democrats are responsible because they did not respond enough to the class interests of the white working class. Now, of course, he doesn't ask and answer the basic question, which is that it's not just the white working class is doing badly nowadays, it's the entire working class. And so he should ask himself, well, then why hasn't the black working class turned to the right, turned towards Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, for example? And this is the kind of weak-kneed thinking that is paving the way for the kind of right-wing trends that you were pointed to. Certainly, the rising disparity in wealth is also reflected in a very important scholarly study issued last year by Princeton economist Anna Case and her spouse, Nobel laureate Angus Deaton, which suggested that the mortality rates for the white working class and white middle class in the United States who are of middle age is reaching AIDS-like levels, pandemic-like levels, and that is largely due to opiate addiction, suicide, and alcoholism, which in many ways is an expression of angst and despair, a kind of angst and despair that makes these people more susceptible to the blandishments and to the siren songs of borderline fascist candidates, to use the phrase of Tom Friedman of the New York Times this morning, borderline fascist candidates like Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. All in all, it seems to me we have a lot to be concerned about.
So I know that you have a new book coming out about Paul Robeson, and certainly one of my heroes. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the book and how his life and work kind of relates to what we're kind of experiencing now.
Well, first of all, Paul Robeson, as you well know, was born in New Jersey in 1898, passed away in Philadelphia in 1976. In between those years, he was an All-American athlete in football, in particular at Rutgers University, a graduate of Columbia University Law School, and a lawyer for a brief period of time, a star of stage and screen, indeed was probably Hollywood's brightest star of the 1920s and the 1930s. Of course, he lived in exile in London for a good deal of the 1920s and 1930s and would have stayed there indefinitely, but for the onset of World War II in Europe in 1939. Coming back to the United States, he, of course, rallied labor and the black community against fascism, but after World War II ended, he was persecuted mercilessly by the U.S. authorities because he refused to turn his back on the socialist project. In fact, his income plummeted from the six figures to the low four figures. His passport was taken so he couldn't go abroad, where he was wildly popular, to make his livelihood, and his health deteriorated. He finally got his passport back in the late 1950s, immediately went back to London, where he felt much more comfortable than he felt in the United States of America for reasons that should be evident. But his health deteriorating caused him to return to the United States in 1965 to a life of seclusion until he died in 1976. Now, with this talk all over the airwaves about an impending boycott of the Oscars ceremony, I find it very interesting to consider this in the context of the life of Paul Robeson, not only because he was Hollywood's brightest black star in the 1920s and 1930s, but also because he turned his back on Hollywood and stopped doing movies in the early 1940s, not least because he found it difficult to find suitable roles. And so it seems that 70 years after Paul Robeson turned his back on Hollywood, you still have these festering problems in Hollywood. But perhaps worse than that, just like Robeson was persecuted for raising an outcry against Jim Crow and bigotry, I find it very curious that these B-list Hollywood stars like Stacey Dash, who denounced Spike Lee and Jada Pinkett Smith for their critique of the Oscar ceremony. Recall that she was the star of Clueless, and of course she is Clueless, and the fact that Jada Pinkett Smith and Will Smith, her spouse, are being denounced in homophobic terms by B-list stars like Alexis Arquette. What this reminds us is that despite Paul Robeson's heroic sacrifice, and despite the trail that he blazed, it still remains very difficult to raise an outcry against the powers that be without being slimed and savaged, even by those who do not have any power, such as Stacey Dash and Alexis Arquette.
Wow. You know, we have obviously a lot more that we could talk about, and we'll do it because we try to talk to you as often as we can throughout the year. So, but thank you for being with us on our F-word anniversary.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so, but we'll have to go. I've run out of time. So that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and I want to thank again author and activist Gerald Horn. Also, thanks to Chantel James for her reporting at U Street and in Annapolis. And thanks to our engineer today, Mike Vernon, and with an assist by Mike Nasella. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Our year in special with Gerald Horn, Barbara Arnwine, Kevin Zeese, and Margaret Flowers is posted there as well. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. We are looking for volunteers and interns who are interested in working in radio and digital media. Write us at contact@onthegroundshow. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace.